Oh!
Yeah.
Things will never be the same now,
it's
Dr.
recording.
Jenkins.
All right. Well, let's just see how this goes. Welcome to the first ever episode of Last Week in Medicine. I'm Dr. Stephen Jenkins, a hospitalist at the University of Utah. And I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Austin Rupp, who's also a hospitalist at the University of Utah.
Hello.
Austin did his med school at?
The University of Nebraska.
All right.
Where'd you do your med school,
Dr. Jenkins? I did mine here at the University of Utah. I'm a Utah man all the way.
Fair enough. We're going to use our first names, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That doctor stuff is just pretentious.
Okay.
Okay,
so, Austin, you're Steven.
Yeah. So the idea for this podcast kind of, for me, came as when I was a resident, and it was just really hard to stay on top of all of the new medical literature that was coming out. I wanted to be up to date on everything, but it's just overwhelming. And there's this one doctor at the University of Utah, Barry Stoltz, who just like, you know, every time I see him, he's carrying like a stack of journals, and I think he's just reading them all the time. And I even had a patient tell me that Barry was reading journal articles when he was standing in line at Disneyland. Like, he's just constantly reading journal articles. And I thought, man, wouldn't it be great if once a week Barry put together a podcast where he just distilled all of the journal articles he'd read for the last week and just shared all of that wisdom and knowledge, and I could just listen to it, you know, on my way to work once a week, and I would be totally caught up on everything. And
that would be awesome.
And it was like a pipe dream that I had. And I don't think Barry would have any interest in doing a podcast like that. In fact, I'm confident I can say his name because he'll never listen to this podcast.
I still call him Dr. Stoltz. I can't call him Barry. But I think you're right about him.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's kind of the goal for this, though, is to, like, just have, like, you know, 15 to 20 minutes once a week where you can just kind of catch up on some of the latest medical literature that's actually relevant and maybe will change the way that you practice medicine. So that's the goal. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. So I'm from Nebraska. I'm married. My wife is also a doctor. She does primary care and is med peds trained. We have two dogs. We like the outdoors. And an interesting fact about me is that I can kind of unicycle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you didn't know that, did you?
Didn't know that about you.
There you go.
But I also don't believe it.
Yeah, you're probably right.
I need proof.
Fair enough.
And what's your favorite NBA team?
Utah Jazz. Take note.
Yeah, take.
Why don't you tell us about you a little too, Steven, so our listeners know who you are.
Yeah, so I'm a Utah guy. I grew up here, did med school here, did my residency here. I am also married with two children. We also love the outdoors, so whenever I'm not working at the hospital, we try to go explore somewhere in the state of Utah. Also, I have way too many pets, including a hedgehog, a sulcata tortoise, two rabbits, and a dog. So we're running a little zoo at my house.
And some ducks previously.
I used to have some ducks.
We won't get into that.
Raccoon got them. It was very gory. All right, so let's jump
in. Let's do it.
Yeah, so the first article I wanted to talk about was this article, and it was in the JAMA Internal Medicine. It's called Clinical Outcomes After Intensifying Antihypertensive Medication Regimens Among Older Adults at Hospital Discharge. And it's by Dr. Timothy Anderson and his colleagues. And basically it's about, you know, adding blood pressure meds or increasing the dose at the time of discharge or during the patient's hospital stay. And I think this comes up all the time, right? Like, a patient gets admitted for one thing, like a UTI, and then, you know, you restart all their home blood pressure meds, but you notice their blood pressure still, like, seems to be frozen in the 150s, and you try to ignore it, you know, but, you know, every day the pharmacist is like, should we add something? And you're like, oh, I guess we could just, you know, throw a little amlodipine at them. It seems harmless, but this article seemed to maybe call that into question.
That it did. Yeah, I think the main question is, should we worry about chronic conditions? That's kind of the larger frame, right? Should we worry about chronic conditions in the acute setting? And what does, you know, elevated blood pressures in the acute setting mean? And should we act?
Yeah, so they did a propensity match cohort of like 4,000 hospitalized adults over the age of 65, and they're in the VA medical center. So they looked at people that were admitted for very common things like pneumonia, UTI, or a venous thromboembolism, and they were evenly split between those who did versus did not receive antihypertensive intensification at discharge. And that was defined as like a new blood pressure med or an increased dose on a previous blood pressure medication. And they excluded patients that were admitted for like atrial fibrillation or acute coronary syndrome or stroke, where they, you know, might need a modification to their blood pressure medications as part of their treatment. So the findings were that the patients with intensified blood pressure treatment were more likely to be readmitted within 30 days of discharge, with a number needed to harm of 27. Okay. And they were also more likely to have ER visits and hospitalizations for serious adverse events, which they defined as a composite of injurious falls, hypotension, syncope, electrolyte abnormalities, or acute kidney injury. So, yeah, increasing their blood pressure medications, you know, you'd think would be kind of a harmless thing, but it actually had some negative outcomes.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. I had a few little points to make on this article. It was interesting to me that two out of the three conditions that they looked at were infections. They had UTIs and pneumonia admissions, and I wonder if that skewed the results a little bit because, you know, it's sort of weird that folks' blood pressure would be increased in the setting of infection where you would think the opposite would be true. So that was just a little interesting to me. And then they also, although they excluded ACS, AFib, and CVA patients, they included heart failure, acute MI, coronary artery disease, and renal disorders in the patient populations. And so those seem like sort of in the same category as, you know, ACS, AFib, and stroke in some ways. And so
were those secondary diagnoses? Because the primary diagnosis was UTI pneumonia or VTE.
Right, right. I'm much more likely to add a blood pressure medication in someone who's admitted for pneumonia who has heart failure than I am in someone who doesn't have heart failure, I would say. So I just wonder if that kind of skewed things a little bit.
So, you know, another interesting thing, though, is like you'd assume if I'm increasing someone's blood pressure medications that maybe, you know, a year from now they'd have fewer heart attacks or strokes or things like that. And they actually looked at that and there was no difference in cardiovascular events at 1 year and really no difference in mortality. So you basically got some, you know, serious adverse events without really any benefits. They did do a subgroup analysis, though, that showed the patients who had well-controlled blood pressure before hospitalization were more likely to have readmissions and serious adverse events, which kind of makes sense. You know, if they were previously well-controlled, there's really no need to step up therapy while they're in the hospital. Whereas patients with elevated blood pressure at baseline who got the intensified regimen actually did okay. And so if you're able to access, you know, their previous blood pressure results and you see that they're always elevated and they've never been started on something, you know, that may be a moment where it's worth starting a medication and the risk is lower.
Yeah, yeah. I think they made a really good point in here. They had a line where they say, after discharge, adults have a well-established increased susceptibility to both adverse drug events and hospital readmissions. And I think that, for me, was sort of the takeaway, you know. If their chronic disease is well-controlled or even not well-controlled, you may do more harm than good by trying to mess with that. So leave well enough alone because folks are more susceptible to stuff right after discharge, which we've said now a couple times. So
yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's move on. Next article, this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, risk factors and outcomes associated with treatment of asymptomatic bacteriuria in hospitalized patients. This comes from Dr. Lindsay Petty and her colleagues from University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. It was published in JAMA Internal Medicine. And they're looking at risk factors and outcomes in patients who were admitted and treated for asymptomatic bacteriuria. And this comes up all the time. I feel like every day in the hospital. In fact, I got a patient overnight with this dilemma where a patient has a positive UA, but that does not equal a UTI, right? So UTI is that, you know, so UTI is diagnosed when you have signs or symptoms of UTI, like dysuria, urgency, frequency, flank pain, suprapubic pain, etc., and evidence of UTI and UA. And obviously, some patients aren't able to tell you if they have symptoms or not. So the typical story goes something like an older patient with dementia is brought in from a nursing home because they're confused. They're unable to confirm or deny symptoms of a UTI. But the ED gets a UA and it has a positive nitrite and some white blood cells. And they call you and they're like, bro, this patient has a raging UTI. And they've already given the patient some ceftriaxone and they're patting each other on the back for solving the case. And now it's possible that this patient has a UTI, but there's lots of reasons that an older patient from a nursing home could have altered mental status. And, you know, rates of urinary colonization are very high. So, you know, obviously you need to be careful about anchoring, and premature closure, et cetera.
Agreed. Yeah. So I think the point here was that they're trying to investigate who actually does get treated for asymptomatic bacteriuria. We sort of recognize that this is a problem and an issue and that the patient you've just described is very common. But there's not a lot of research or data about who gets treated, why they get treated, and what happens to them. And so they're trying to look at that.
Yeah, and the way they did it, I mean, I think was pretty impressive. So they have a large hospital consortium in Michigan with 46 hospitals. It includes academic and community hospitals. And they identified 7,250 patients with positive urine cultures. And then they excluded pregnant patients, patients with recent urologic procedures. And they found that 2,772 of them did not have any symptoms of UTI documented in their chart. So they actually had these specially trained abstractors that went through every chart looking for documentation of signs or symptoms of UTI, like the ones we mentioned. And the numbers are kind of staggering, in my opinion. 83% of them got antibiotics, which kind of blew my mind. And that does include, you know, just the one, you know, the person that got one dose of ceftriaxone in the ER, but the median duration of antibiotic treatment was 7 days.
So too long.
Most of the patients were getting, you know, at least 3 days of antibiotics. So who were these patients? Well, 78% of them were women. The median age was 77 years old. 21% of them had dementia. 13% of them had indwelling urinary catheters. An interesting thing to me was 94% of them had pyuria on their UA, which, you know,
shouldn't they all have pyuria on their UA? That was a question I had. If there's a positive UA that triggers treatment, which equals asymptomatic bacteriuria, what other positive signs of UA are
there? Well, I mean, the UA has, it can detect bacteria, so I feel like a lot of these people just have bacteria positive on their UA without necessarily white blood cells.
Okay.
But most of these patients did have, you know, more than 5 white blood cells, which, you know, that's hardly anything.
Do you consider if a patient has bacteria on their UA without whites, you that's a positive UA for you?
Well, I would say they have asymptomatic bacteriuria.
I suppose that's the definition, isn't it?
Yeah.
I really anchor on the white cells. You know, that's sort of what I feel like we've been taught, or I've been taught, is they need to have evidence of inflammation and that, you know, there's pathophysiology going on there because, I mean, you're right, asymptomatic bacteriuria is bacteria in the urine, but if there's no pyuria or, like, physiologic response, then it's more likely colonization, right? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, but I don't think pyuria, having white blood cells in the urine, does not equal infection.
Agreed, and that's the central point. You're right. They probably just had bacteria, not white cells. But I really like the white cells to get me thinking about infection. Anyway.
Your personal bias. So yeah. What do you think the most common bacteria was?
E. coli.
Yeah, 50% had E. coli, followed closely, not really, by Klebsiella at 15%. Remember in med school when you learned that Staph saprophyticus is like one of the most common causes of UTI?
Can't say I do remember that.
Oh, I feel like that was like a board's question or something. I've never seen anyone with Staph saprophyticus. I just wanted to put that out there.
Noted.
Yeah. So their analysis did show that the patient was more likely to get antibiotics if they were old or had altered mental status, which is not surprising. But very interestingly to me, patients with at least two SIRS criteria, excluding fever, because that was one of the exclusion criteria, or patients with a QSOFA score of 2 were not more likely to get antibiotics. And it seems like if you were using those scores appropriately, like you would want to give those people the antibiotics, not the demented old lady who can't tell you yes or no.
Agreed. That was striking to me as well.
So what about patient outcomes? So there was no difference in 30-day mortality, 30-day readmission, 30-day post-discharge ER visits, or discharge to post-acute care facilities. And there was no difference in Clostridioides difficile infections.
So maybe we should be giving these people antibiotics.
No!
Oh, okay.
They do point out that the patients who got antibiotics had an increased length of stay in the hospital by about an extra day, which obviously is more expensive, exposes the patient to other risks and harms. And it makes you wonder if maybe that extra day was just some jokers waiting around for a urine culture to come back, which I feel like we run into that all the time. Like, oh, patient is better, but we don't have the urine culture results yet. And, you know, you don't want it to be Pseudomonas after you discharge them.
Right. Then they'll have to come back from the sniff because of contact precautions when they have an ESBL Pseudomonas.
So what are you going to do with this information?
Yeah, I think this is just another tool or sort of evidence for us to try and not treat these folks. A few points that I thought were interesting was that the symptoms that they used to classify folks as asymptomatic were set forth by the IDSA and the National Healthcare Safety Network. And they mentioned autonomic dysreflexia and increased spasticity as symptoms in, you know, for example, spinal cord injury patients. That's an area that's also sort of fraught with lack of clarity.
Sure.
And I wonder, you know,
some of that can be subjective.
Right. Autonomic dysreflexia and spasticity, very subjective. And overall, symptoms are very hard to ascertain,
to pin down.
You know, you ask the patient, the resident asks the patient, the intern asks the patient, and the medical student asks the patient. And by the fourth time they get asked, they do have suprapubic pain. So
you think there's some reinforcing behavior?
There very well may be. But, I mean, we can't, you know, we don't have anything else, so I don't think that we should disregard that. But that was something that I thought was worth mentioning. And then, additionally, urine culture by itself was associated with a longer stay. So, you know, whether or not they got treated, just a urine culture keeps folks in the hospital longer. And I was not aware of this, which maybe I should have been, but there are guidelines for asymptomatic bacteriuria as put out by IDSA, so that's something that we should all look into. So I think overall, try not to treat people who don't have symptoms and who may have a positive UA is the main takeaway here. Sometimes, though, it's kind of nice when the ER gives that dose of antibiotics. You don't have to worry about it. It's tucked away. You got 24 hours to figure something out.
Anyway. Yeah, and apparently they didn't have higher, you know, rates of C. diff, so that's good. I mean, I think, yeah, you get this old patient that gets admitted with, you know, altered mental status, and they have this positive urine, but, you know, you're not convinced that's what's really driving this. You're obviously going to look for other causes, like, you know, medications, or maybe they're dehydrated. But if they do have, like, a positive QSOFA screen, like a score of 2 for low blood pressure and fast respiratory rate, and you don't have a better explanation for infection, I think it's reasonable to give those folks antibiotics early versus holding off and waiting to see if they get better without antibiotics. I found it illuminating. All right, well, we're going longer than I thought we would, so we got to do this last article here. So this last one is called Antibiotic Use and Outcomes After Implementation of the Drug Resistance and Pneumonia Score in ED Patients with Community Onset Pneumonia. This was originally published in May online in Chest, but it's in the November issue. And it comes from University of Utah alum Brandon Webb, did his infectious disease fellowship here, so he's kind of like a minor celebrity at the University of Utah. He's famous, though, because he created this widely distributed chart that shows a spectrum of antibiotic sensitivities of different antibiotics. And when I got that chart as an intern, it changed my life.
I did not know that was him.
Yeah, he made that chart when he was a fellow.
Thank you, Dr. Webb.
Seriously, all of our residents, medical students have that chart. It makes it so much easier to pick appropriate antibiotics.
I don't let the residents see me use it, but I use it all the time.
Yeah, don't tell. Yeah. Telegraph that weakness. So Dr. Webb is also famous for deriving the DRIP score, which stands for drug resistance in pneumonia, back in 2013. And this score includes 10 well-established risk factors for drug-resistant pneumonia. And a DRIP score of 4 has a 71% sensitivity and 82% specificity for a drug-resistant pathogen on culture. And so the goal of the DRIP score was to more accurately identify patients with pneumonia who need broad-spectrum antibiotics. So our listeners may remember the ill-fated healthcare-associated pneumonia, or HCAP, guidelines of 2005, which led to a doubling in the use of vancomycin and zosyn, or I guess I should call it piptazo.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Webb created the DRIP tool as a way to reduce utilization of broad-spectrum antibiotics and more appropriately target the right patients. So he works at Intermountain Medical Center, and that's a system famous for early adoption of electronic medical records and informatics. And they had already created a decision support tool called eNeumonia that uses CURB-65 and other severity criteria to guide decision-making for emergency department physicians at 4 Intermountain hospitals. So in 2014, they added the DRIP score to this support tool. And a DRIP score of less than 4 recommended ceftriaxone plus azithromycin. A DRIP score of 4 or greater recommended an anti-pseudomonal beta-lactam plus vancomycin and azithromycin. So this paper is actually a comparison of patients treated in 2015 using the DRIP score and 2012 when they were still using the old HCAP guidelines.
As integrated into the eNeumonia tool. Right.
Yeah, it's really nice. You just plug in the patient information and it just tells you what antibiotics to give them. Yeah. So in total, they analyzed 2,169 adult admissions, about equally distributed in each year. In 2012, based on the old HCAP guidelines, broad-spectrum antibiotics were ordered in 40% of admissions. In 2015, with the DRIP score, prescribing went down to 33% of admissions with a p-value of less than 0.001. And they significantly reduced the amount of days that the patients received vancomycin. There were not significant differences in mortality, length of stay, cost, or C. diff infections.
Yeah, I think additionally, the identification of pathogen statistics is pretty interesting. The prevalence of drug resistance was 2.3%. The rate of inadequate treatment with eNeumonia DRIP is 0.66%, and broad spectrum use, like you said, Stephen, continued to be 18.9%. So my sort of takeaways were that even with this tool, broad spectrum antibiotic use decreased. Even with the tool, you're still treating with broad-spectrum antibiotics at a tenfold rate above when there actually are drug-resistant pathogens. Additionally, to take a step back, the micro data that we got, where a pathogen was identified in 12.7% in 2012 and 15.8% in 2015. So that's potentially a criticism and always an issue with pneumonia, right? You always have problems identifying the pathogen, and using scores like this is always going to be tricky because it's just hard to get a bug.
Yeah, and at Intermountain, they're actually probably more aggressive than most hospitals in using different, you know, labs to get at that. So they use MRSA nasal swabs, unlike everybody. It's a PCR test, which we do not have at our institution. And it looked like in this study in 2015, 11% of patients got that nasal swab, which was nice because if they were negative, then they were allowed to discontinue vancomycin early. So about 75% of patients with a negative MRSA nasal swab PCR got their vanc discontinued early. But I wasn't really clear if a positive MRSA nasal swab was, you know, considered a positive diagnostic test for a pathogen. They didn't really specify that. Another interesting thing was all these patients got a PCR film array that includes mycoplasma and chlamydophila, and they only had 7 cases of mycoplasma in 2015 out of 1,000, and 1 case of chlamydophila. And, you know, PCR testing is expensive, so it makes you wonder if that test is really that high yield. And they also tested Legionella urine antigens on everyone and diagnosed a whopping 3 people out of 1,000 with Legionella pneumonia. So I guess I was wondering, like, are we way over utilizing azithromycin? Like, the rate of these atypical pneumonias was so low. Like, do we even need a macrolide?
Yeah, you know, that's a question I have as well. And I'm wondering how this study and our care pathway for CAP specifically is going to potentially need to change with the new guidelines. We're not here to talk about the new guidelines, but the new guidelines that came out in October, I believe, really emphasize severe versus non-severe CAP and actually recommend against obtaining microdata unless it's severe pneumonia, which will decrease our pathogen yield even further. Mm. But, you know, the main question is who has risk factors for drug-resistant pathogens, and interestingly, the new CAP guidelines sort of seem to pass on that question almost. They talk about, you know, prior infection is the strongest risk factor, and then antibiotic use within the last 90 days, and they kind of leave it at that. So I'm wondering how the DRIP score might be integrated. How you sort of reconcile the DRIP score with the new guidelines? It does seem to be an effective tool in reducing broad spectrum antibiotics, but in my mind, it remains to be seen where this will sort of settle out. And you know, we know HCAP is dead, but is DRIP dead? I don't think so.
That's a great question. I mean, DRIP was so hot when we were residents because it was like, you know, 2013, I think, is when they first published on it, and so we were all getting indoctrinated pretty heavy on DRIP. And I think that was probably a local phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And so I will say that I think about it a lot less now than I did when I was a resident. But, you know, internists love risk scores, so it will never die completely.
Right.
I did notice it's not in my MDCalc app yet, so I don't know, you know, what it takes to get MDCalc to include a new score.
I thought it was there.
At least not on my phone app.
Oh, maybe.
Maybe online they incorporate more. Is it on there?
It's on here.
Yeah. Oh, wow. All right. Go to mdcalc.com and you can look up the DRIP score if you want to know all the different risk factors for that. Well, we've been gabbing for 28 minutes, which is more than I thought we would. So I think it's time to wrap this up. Okay. I forgot. I wanted to mention a couple more articles in our honorable mentions that we just don't have time to really talk about in depth, but I think they're important articles to know about. So the first one is in the New England Journal this week, and it was about triple therapy for cystic fibrosis for patients who had at least one copy of the phenylalanine deletion, which is apparently the most common mutation. About 90% of patients have that mutation. The patients who got the triple therapy had fewer exacerbations, higher quality of life on surveys, lower sweat chloride tests, and a better FEV1 than those who got placebo. So obviously that's a really big deal for the cystic fibrosis community. Very exciting. The drug is going to be called Trikafta, and it will be about $24,000 a month. So that comes out to close to $300,000 a year. So thank you, Pharma, for making the drug. But holy crap, does that have to be that much money? I guess it's worth it, though, if it really makes a big difference for people with cystic fibrosis. And then the other article I wanted to mention was published online in the JAMA Internal Medicine. The title was Mind-Body Therapies for Opioid-Treated Pain. It was a meta-analysis of 60 randomized controlled trials with 6,400 patients. And they found that mind-body therapies like meditation and cognitive behavioral therapy were associated with pain reduction and reduced opioid doses. So that's some pretty exciting stuff for the chronic pain world. I wonder if there's a way we can incorporate that into our hospital-based practice. Probably not.
You don't teach your patients mindfulness, mind-body?
I turn on the app every day for them. All right, that's it. If you're actually still listening, thank you for your perseverance. And yeah, we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
And then we have some cool rock music to like take us out.
Do we need
out.
To do like disclaimers or something too? Like.